He told them what he wanted, and they put it together for him. It sounds quaint in this era of the internet and UPS shipments. He came back 3 days later to pick it up. Those 3 days felt like a week, Linus says. On January 5th, he got his dad to help him drive the thing home. Not only was it no name, it was also nondescript. It was a basic gray block. He didn't buy this computer because it looked cool. It was a very boring-looking machine with a 14-inch screen. He wanted something dependable and with easy access to the upgrades he would inevitably require. The computer came with a cut-down version of DOS. Linus wanted to run Minix, the Unix variant, so he ordered it, and the operating system took more than a month to make its way to Finland. The wasted month felt like about 6 years to Linus. Minix finally arrived on a Friday afternoon, and he installed it that night. It required feeding 16 floppy disks into the computer. The entire weekend was devoted to getting accustomed to the new system. He learned what he liked about the operating system, and, more importantly, what he didn't like. He tried to compensate for its shortcomings by downloading programs that he had become accustomed to from the university computer. In all, it took him a month or more to make it his own system. Andrew Tannenbaum, the professor in Amsterdam who wrote Minix, wanted to keep the operating system as a teaching aid, so it had been crippled on purpose, in bad ways. There were patches to Minix, improvements, that is, including a well-known patch made by a hacker in Australia named Bruce Evans, who was the god of Minix 386. His improvement made Minix much more usable on a 386. Before even getting the computer, Linus had been following the Minix newsgroups online, so he knew from the very beginning that he wanted to run his enhanced version. But because of the licensing situation, he had to buy the real version of Minix and then do a lot of work to bootstrap Evans' patches. It was a fairly major thing to do. There were a number of features that disappointed Linus with Minix. The biggest letdown was terminal emulation, which was important because it was the program he used to connect to the university computer. He relied upon terminal emulation whenever he wanted to dial up the university's computer to either work on the powerful Unix computer or just go online. So Linus began a project to create his own terminal emulation program. He didn't want to do the project under Minix, but instead to do it at the bare hardware level. This terminal emulation project would also be a great opportunity to learn how the 386 hardware worked. For Linus, the most important part of the project was to just figure out what this machine did and have fun with it. Because he programmed to the bare metal, he had to start off from the BIOS, which is the early ROM code that the computer boots into. The BIOS reads either the floppy or the hard disk, and in this case, he had his program on a floppy. The BIOS reads the first sector of the floppy and starts executing it. This was Linus's first PC, and he had to learn how all this was done. This all happens in what's called real mode, but in order to take advantage of the whole CPU and get into 32-bit mode, you have to go into protected mode. There's a lot of complicated setup you have to do to make this happen. So to create a terminal emulation program this way, you need to know how the CPU works. In fact, part of the reason Linus wrote in assembly language was just to learn about the CPU. The other things you need to know are how to write to the screen, how to read keyboard input, how to read and write to the modem. Linus wanted to have two independent threads. One thread would read from the modem and then display on the screen. The other thread would read from the keyboard and write out to the modem. And there would be two pipes going both ways. This is called task switching, and a 386 had hardware to support this process. Linus thought it was a cool idea. His earliest test program was written to use one thread to write the letter A to the screen. The other thread wrote the letter B. I know it sounds unimpressive, and he programmed this to happen a number of times a second. With a timer interrupt, he wrote it so that the screen would fill with A, 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 A. Then, all of a sudden, it would switch to B, 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 B. It's a completely useless exercise from any practical standpoint, but it was a good way of showing that his task switching worked. It took maybe a month to do this because he had to learn everything as he was going along. So ultimately, he was able to change the two threads, the AAAAA and BBBBBBB, so that one read from the modem and wrote to the screen, and the other read from the keyboard and wrote to the modem. Linus had his own terminal emulation program. When he wanted to read news, he would put in his floppy and reboot the machine, and he would read news from the university computer using his program. If he wanted to make changes to improve the terminal emulation package, he would boot into Minix and use it for programming. And he was very proud of it. Linus's sister Sarah knew about his great personal accomplishment. He showed it to her, and she looked at the screens of AAAAAAs and BBBBBBBs for about 5 seconds. Then she said, "Good," and went away, unimpressed. Linus realized it didn't look like much. It's completely impossible to explain to somebody else that, while something may not look like much, a lot is going on in the background. Probably the only other person who saw it was Lars, the other Swedish-speaking computer science major who started the same year Linus did. It was March, maybe April, and if the snow was turning to slush, Linus didn't know, or much care. He was spending most of his time in a bathrobe, huddled over his unattractive new computer, with thick black window shades shielding him from the sunlight, not to mention the outside world. He was eking out the monthly payments for his PC, which was scheduled to be paid off in 3 years. What he didn't know was that he would only be sending in payments for another year. By then, he would have written Linux, which would be seen by many more people than just Sarah and Lars. By that time, Peter Anvin, who works with Linus now at Transmeta, would have started a collection on the internet to get his computer paid off. Everybody knew he wasn't making any money on Linux. People just started saying, "Let's start a collection to pay off Linus's computer." It was wonderful. He had absolutely no money. Linus always felt it was important to not have asked for money or begged for money, but the fact that it was simply given to him was overwhelming. That's how Linux got started, with Linus's test programs turning into a terminal emulation package. Red Herring magazine sends me to Finland to report on Oulu, the emerging high-tech center that is home to 141 startups despite its forbidding location a few hours' drive from the Arctic Circle. It's a good opportunity to hook up with Linus's parents and his sister Sarah in Helsinki. His father Nils, who goes by the name Nicky, meets me in the lobby of the hotel, across the plaza from the Helsinki railway station. He is trim, wears thick glasses, bears Lenin's beard. He has recently ended his 4-year assignment in Moscow for the Finnish broadcasting company and is now writing a book about Russia and deciding whether or not to take a post in Washington, a place he doesn't find interesting. Months earlier, he had won a prestigious National Journalism Award, a commendation that his ex-wife Anna later would say mellowed him considerably. In the early evening, he drives me in his Volvo V40 on a tour of Linus's snow-crusted neighborhoods, pointing out the solid building in which both father and son attended elementary school, driving past the grandparents' apartment where Linus lived in his first 3 months, and then the Parkview building in which the family lived for the following 7 years. Nicky had spent one of those years in Moscow, studying to be a communist, when Linus was 5 years old. Next, he points out the pale yellow apartment building in which Linus and his sister moved following the divorce. A street-level adult video store has replaced the electronic supply store of Linus's youth. And finally, we drive past the most substantial of the structures, the 5-story apartment block in which his maternal grandparents resided, the birthplace of Linux. Linus's mother, Anna, still lives there. This could be Manhattan's Upper East Side in late December. Nicky is funny, smart, self-deprecating, and shares a host of gestures with his son, like the way he cradles his chin in his hand when he talks. They also share a grin. Unlike his son, he is a lifelong athlete, a socialist jock, who plays on a basketball team, runs 5 miles a day, and has taken to swimming distances in an icy lake early each morning. At 55, he walks with the athletic confidence of someone maybe two-thirds his age. Another trait he does not share with Linus, Nikki seems to have had a complicated romantic life. We have dinner in a bustling restaurant in central Helsinki, where Nikki talks about the difficulty Linus had growing up as the son of an overactive communist who was a frequent public speaker and at one point held a minor public office. He explains that Linus often was teased about his father's radical politics, and that some parents even refused to let him play with their children. For that reason, explains Nikki, his son made a constant effort to distance himself from the left-wing rhetoric that was the backdrop of his childhood. He wouldn't let me discuss it. He would leave the room, Nikki says, or else he always made a point of having an opposing view. I know Linus was teased in school for having the wrong father. The message to me was, don't put me in this awkward situation. Nikki drives me to his home, where he says we will drink beer in his kitchen. It is north of the Central Business District, in a collection of buildings that were originally built in the 1920s to house workers. We ascend the steps to his apartment and remove our shoes in the entry. The place recalls the late 1960s counterculture, with woven basket lampshades, third world wall hangings, house plants. We sit at the kitchen table, where Nikki pours beer and we talk about fathering. A parent shouldn't think that it is he who makes his children what they are, he says, reaching for his mobile phone to dial up the woman with whom he lives. He indicates that Linus is just starting to read the historical books he has been bugging him to read for years, and that Linus probably has never bothered to read his own grandfather's poetry. I ask Nikki if he has ever expressed an interest in programming, ever asked Linus to show him the fundamentals. He tells me he never has. Fathers and sons are unique individuals, he reasons, explaining that the act of delving into Linus's passion would be akin to invading his soul. He seems comfortable in the role of father to a famous person. In a recent newspaper profile following his winning of the National Journalism Award, he was quoted as saying that, even in the days when he picked Linus up from the playground, other kids would point and say, "Look, there's Linus's father." Sarah Torvalds has traveled by train from her home in a small city west of Helsinki, where the street signs are in Swedish first and Finnish second, and where she can afford an apartment with a clawfoot tub and sauna, and where, to her delight, Swedish, not Finnish, is heard on the streets. As she explains, she is a minority within a minority. As a young adult, she converted to Catholicism, an act that relegated her to the less than 10% of Finnish citizens who are non-Lutherans and caused her agnostic father to disown her for a matter of weeks. Today she has traveled to Helsinki to teach catechism to youngsters under a government-sponsored program. She is pleasant and upbeat, and at 29 she exudes the uncynical spirit of an earnest and busy high schooler. Her fair skin and round face give her a vague resemblance to her older brother, but it is obvious that she is naturally more sociable than he is. She regularly taps the keys of her mobile phone to send text messages to friends she will be meeting later in the day. Then, just as frequently, she checks for replies. She has a successful translation business. It is noon and Sarah is taking me to meet her mother for lunch, with stops at various childhood locales, the park, the elementary school. My parents were card-carrying communists, so that's how we were brought up, to think the Soviet Union was a good thing. We visited Moscow, she explains. What I remember most was the huge toy store they had, bigger than anything in Helsinki. Her parents divorced when she was 6. She says, I remember when we were told that Dad would be moving out for good. I thought, that's good. Now the fighting will stop. Actually, he had been going to Moscow for long periods, so we were used to him going away. By the time she was 10, Sarah opted to move in with her father, who had relocated to a neighboring city, rather than live with her mother and Linus. It wasn't that I didn't want to live with Mom. It was just that I didn't want to live with Linus. That way we would only fight on weekends. We fought all the time. Little by little, we fought less as we grew older. We arrive at her mother's first-floor apartment, and Anna Torvalds is thrilled to see us. Mickey is her nickname. She refuses to let me indulge in the Finnish custom of removing one's shoes. Don't be silly. This place is already dusty. You couldn't possibly make it worse. She is short, dark-haired, and extremely quick-witted. Within seconds of our arrival, the telephone rings. A real estate agent wants to show me the vacant apartment adjacent to Mickey's so that I could describe it to her son in the United States and hand-deliver literature about it in the event that he might want to purchase the place as a sort of Helsinki pied-à-terre. We enter the sprawling apartment where the agent, who bears an eerie resemblance to the Annette Bening character in the film American Beauty, instructs us to slip little blue cloth booties over our shoes before we take the tour. Soon the agent, in an annoyingly cheerful tone, says something like, "Now this room here, it's a perfect room for antiques that you wouldn't want to have damaged by the sun." Mickey shoots me a conspiratorial glance and replies, in a mocking voice, "Oh, what a delightful way of telling us this room doesn't get any light." Back in her own kitchen, Mickey sits at a rectangular table bearing a colorful tablecloth and pours coffee into an oversized mug. Her apartment, like that of her ex-husband, brims with books and folk art. There are black and white Marimekko curtains. The apartment originally contained 3 bedrooms and a kitchen. When her children moved out, Mickey moved into the large bedroom that had been occupied by Sarah. She then dismantled the walls around Linus's room and those around her original bedroom to create a huge living room kitchen. She points to a vacant spot and says, "That's where his computer was. I guess I should put up some sort of plaque. What do you think?" She chain smokes. She is an easy conversationalist with such a solid command of English that there are no pauses when she delivers a phrase like, "He's not some random schmuck you meet on the street." Mickey pulls out an album containing the family's few photographs. There's Linus at the age of 2 or 3, naked on the beach. There's Linus at the same age, shooting a moon outside a famous castle near Helsinki. There's Linus as an early adolescent, looking thin and awkward. There's Mickey at a 60th birthday party for her statistics professor father. She points out her older sister and brother. She's a New York psychiatrist. He's a nuclear physicist. And me, I'm the black sheep, right? "But I had the first grandchild," she declares, then lights a Galois. We eat lunch at a restaurant named, inexplicably, for Wilt Chamberlain. Sarah consults her mobile phone while Mickey orders multiple espressos. Mickey recalls the way she and Nikki argued over whether Linus should or should not be forced to give up his pacifier. They wrote notes to each other and left them on the counter. There is talk about Linus's poor memory and his inability to remember faces. If you're watching a movie with him and the hero changes his shirt from red to yellow, Linus will ask, "Who is this guy?" says Sarah. There's talk about a family biking camping vacation to Sweden, sleeping on the overnight ferry, having Sarah's bicycle stolen the first day, spending the budget on a new bicycle, erecting the tent on a cliff, leaving Linus inside to read all day while mother and daughter swam and fished, and then, after a powerful windstorm blew in, realizing that the only thing preventing the tent from being whisked into the Baltic Sea was Linus, who had been sleeping inside, oblivious to the extreme change in weather. Mickey laughs as she relives the years in which Linus hid in his room, slaving away on a computer. "Nikki kept saying to me, 'Kick him out, make him get a job.' But Linus wasn't bothering me. He didn't require much. And whatever it was he was doing with his computer, that was his business, his thing, and he had a right to do it. I had no idea what it was all about." Now she is as current as anyone on her son's activities. Mickey and the other family members are on the receiving end of a continual barrage of media queries. Those requests are forwarded to Linus, who typically responds by telling his mother, father, or sister to use their own judgment when answering. But after they write a response, they generally forward it to Linus for his approval before sending it on to the reporter. Months earlier, when I emailed Mickey requesting her recollections of Linus's childhood, her response was lengthy and well-crafted. She titled her essay, On Raising Linus from a Very Small Nerd. In it, she recounted her early observations that her toddler son showed the same signs of scientific determination she saw in her father and older brother. When you see a person whose eyes glaze over when a problem presents itself or continues to bug him or her, who then does not hear you talking, who fails to answer any simple question, who becomes totally engrossed in the activity at hand, who is ready to forego food and sleep in the process of working out a solution, and who does not give up, ever, he, or she, of course, may be interrupted and in the course of daily life often is, but blithely carries on later, single-mindedly, then you know. She wrote about the sibling rivalry between Linus and Sarah, and about the irreconcilable differences. Sarah, I don't like the taste of mushrooms, liver, whatever. Linus, yes, you do. And the grudging respect. Linus once expressed his awe of his sister very succinctly at an early age. He might have been 5 or 6 or whatever, when he very seriously told me, you see, I don't think any new thoughts. I think thoughts that other people have thought, and I rearrange them. But Sarah, she thinks thoughts that never were before. These reminiscences may reveal that I still don't think Linus has any special talent, and certainly not for computers. If it weren't that, it would be something else. In another day and age, he would focus on some different challenge, and I think he will. What I mean is, I hope he won't be stuck in Linux maintenance forever. For he is, I think, motivated not by computers, and certainly not by fame or riches, but by honest curiosity and a wish to conquer difficulties as they arise, and to do it the right way, because that's the way it is, and he won't give up. It's obvious that both mother and daughter stay abreast of the hullabaloo surrounding his fame. It is late January 2000, the day following Transmeta's big public announcement of what it has been up to, and early in our lunch, Mickey asks Sarah, was there anything in the paper today about you-know-who and you-know-what? That night, on her way to work, Mickey asks her taxi to wait outside my hotel while she drops off a pine child's chair she'd like me to hand-deliver to Patrizia. That, and a floor plan of the available apartment for Linus. Linus doesn't know how to really explain his fascination with programming, but I'll try. To somebody who does it, it's the most interesting thing in the world. It's a game much more involved than chess, a game where you can make up your own rules and where the end result is whatever you can make of it. And yet, to the outside, it looks like the most boring thing on earth. Part of the initial excitement in programming is easy to explain. Just the fact that when you tell the computer to do something, it will do it, unerringly, forever, without a complaint. And that's interesting in itself. But blind obedience on its own, while initially fascinating, obviously does not make for a very likable companion. In fact, that part gets pretty boring fairly quickly. What makes programming so engaging is that, while you can make the computer do what you want, you have to figure out how. Linus says that he is convinced that computer science has a lot in common with physics. Both are about how the world works at a rather fundamental level. The difference, of course, is that while in physics you're supposed to figure out how the world is made up, in computer science you create the world. Within the confines of the computer, you are the creator. You get to ultimately control everything that happens. If you're good enough, you can be God, on a small scale. You get to create your own world, and the only thing that limits what you can do are the capabilities of the machine. And, more and more often these days, your own abilities. Think of a treehouse. You can build a treehouse that is functional and has a trapdoor and is stable. But everybody knows the difference between a treehouse that is simply solidly built and one that is beautiful, that takes creative advantage of the tree. It's a matter of combining art and engineering. This is one of the reasons programming can be so captivating and rewarding. The functionality often is second to being interesting, being pretty, or being shocking. It is an exercise in creativity. The thing that drew Linus into programming in the first place was the process of just figuring out how the computer worked. One of his biggest joys was learning that computers are like mathematics. You get to make up your own world with its own rules. In physics, you're constrained by existing rules, but in math, as in programming, anything goes as long as it's self-consistent. Mathematics doesn't have to be constrained by any external logic, but it must be logical in and of itself. For that world to be beautiful, it can't contain any flaws. That's how programming works. One of the reasons people have become so enamored with computers is that they enable you to experience the new worlds you can create and to learn what's possible. In mathematics, you can engage in mental gymnastics about what might be. For example, when most people think of geometry, they think of Euclidean geometry. But the computer has helped people visualize different geometries, ones that are not at all Euclidean. With computers, you can take these made-up worlds and actually see what they look like. Remember the Mandelbrot set? The fractal images based on Benoit Mandelbrot's equations? These were visual representations of a purely mathematical world that could never have been visualized before computers. Mandelbrot just made up these arbitrary rules about this world that doesn't exist and that has no relevance to reality, but it turned out they created fascinating patterns. With computers and programming, you can build new worlds, and sometimes the patterns are truly beautiful. Most of the time, you're not doing that. You're simply writing a program to do a certain task. In that case, you're not creating a new world, but you are solving a problem within the world of the computer. The operating system is the basis for everything else that will happen in the machine, and creating one is the ultimate challenge. When you create an operating system, you're creating the world in which all the programs running the computer live. Basically, you're making up the rules of what's acceptable and can be done, and what can't be done. Every program does that, but the operating system is the most basic. It's like creating the constitution of the land that you're creating, and all the other programs running on the computer are just common laws. Sometimes the laws don't make sense, but sense is what you strive for. You want to be able to look at the solution and realize that you came to the right answer in the right way. Remember the person in school who always got the right answer? That person did it much more quickly than everybody else, and did it because he or she didn't try to. That person didn't learn how the problem was supposed to be done, but instead just thought about the problem the right way. And once you heard the answer, it made perfect sense. The same is true in computers. You can do something the brute force way, the stupid, grind the problem down until it's not a problem anymore way, or you can find the right approach, and suddenly the problem just goes away. You look at the problem another way, and you have this epiphany. It was only a problem because you were looking at it the wrong way. A great mathematician doesn't solve a problem the long and boring way because he sees what the real pattern is behind the question and applies that pattern to find the answer in a much better way. The same is definitely true in computer science, too. Sure, you can just write a program that calculates the sum. On today's computers, that would be a snap. But a great programmer would know what the answer is simply by being clever. He would know to write a beautiful program that attacks the problem in a new way, that, in the end, is the right way. Linus's terminal emulator grew legs. He was using it regularly to log onto the university computer and read email or participate in the discussions of the Minix newsgroup. But he wanted to download things and upload things. That meant he needed to be able to save things to disk. In order to do that, his terminal emulator would require a disk driver. It also needed to get a file system driver, so that it would be able to look at the organization of the disk and save the stuff he was downloading as files. So he wrote a disk driver, and because he wanted to save files to his Minix file system, and because the Minix file system was well documented anyway, he made his file system compatible with a Minix file system. That way, he could read files he created under Minix and write them to the same disk, so that Minix would be able to read the files he created from his terminal emulation thing. By the time he did this, it was clear the project was on its way to becoming an operating system. So he shifted his thinking of it as a terminal emulator to thinking of it as an operating system. The transition occurred in the hypnosis of one of those marathon programming sessions. Day or night? Linus can't recall. One moment, he was in his threadbare robe, hacking away on a terminal emulator with extra functions. The next moment, he realized it's accumulating so many functions that it has metamorphosed into a new operating system in the making. He called it his GNU Emacs of terminal emulation programs. GNU Emacs started out as an editor, but the people who created it built in a host of functions. They intended it to be an editor that can be programmed, but then the programmability part took over, and it became the editor from hell. It contains everything but the kitchen sink, which is why sometimes the icon for the editor is actually a kitchen sink. It's known for being a huge piece of programming effort that has more functions than any editor needs. The same thing was happening with Linus's terminal emulator. It was growing to be much more. In July 1991, Linus posted a newsgroup message asking for the latest POSIX standards. This was the earliest public evidence that a geek in Finland was willing to test the bounds of his computing skill. The POSIX standards are the lengthy rules for each of the hundreds of system calls in Unix, what you need in order to get the computer to perform its operations, starting with read, write, open, close. POSIX is a Unix standards body, an organization comprised of representatives from companies that want to agree on common guidelines. Standards are important in order for programmers to be able to write applications to the operating system and have them run on more than one version. The system calls, particularly the important ones, would give Linus a list of the various functions needed for an operating system. He would then write the code to make each of those functions happen in his own way. By writing to the POSIX standards, his code would be usable by others. He didn't know at the time that he could have bought those rules in hard copy form directly from POSIX, but it wouldn't have mattered anyway. Even if he could have afforded the cost, it always took a long time to get things shipped to Finland. Hence, his appeal for a version that he could download for free from an FTP site. Nobody responded with a source for the POSIX standards, so Linus went to Plan B. He tracked down manuals for the Sun Microsystems version of Unix at the university, which was operating a Sun server. The manuals contained a basic version of the system calls that was good enough to help him get by. It was possible to look at the manual pages to see what the system call was supposed to do, and then set about the task of implementing it from there. The manual pages didn't say how to do it, they just said what the end results were. He also gleaned some of the system calls from Andrew Tannenbaum's book and a few others. Eventually, somebody sent him the thick volumes containing the POSIX standards. But his email message did not go unnoticed. Any knowledgeable person, and only knowledgeable people would be reading the Minix site, could tell that Linus's project would have to be an operating system. Why else would he want the POSIX rules? The message aroused the curiosity of Ari Lemke, a teaching assistant at Polytechnic University of Helsinki. Ari sent a nice reply, offering to make a subdirectory on the university's FTP site available for when Linus would be ready to post his operating system for anyone who might be interested in downloading it. Ari Lemke must have been quite an optimist. He created the subdirectory long before Linus had something he wanted to release. He had the password and everything was set up for him to just log in and upload stuff to it. But it took about 4 months for him to feel he had anything he was willing to share with the world, or at least with Ari and the few other operating system freaks with whom he had been exchanging email. Linus's original goal was to create an operating system that he could eventually use as a replacement for Minix. It didn't have to do more than Minix, but it had to do the things in Minix that Linus cared about. For example, not only was the Minix terminal emulation bad, but there was no way of performing the job control function, putting a program in the background while you're not using it. And memory management was done very simplistically, as it still is in the Mac OS, incidentally. The way you create an operating system is to find out what the system calls are supposed to do, and then write your own program to implement those system calls in your own way. Generally speaking, there are a couple of hundred system calls. Some of them can represent multiple functions. Others are quite simple. Some of the more fundamental system calls are really complicated and depend on a great deal of infrastructure being there. Take the system calls of write and read. You need to create a disk driver in order to write something to disk or read something from disk. Take open. You have to create the entire file system layer that parses the names and figures out where on the disk everything is. It took months just to write the open system call. But once it was in place, the same code could be used for other functions. That's how the early development was done. Linus was reading the standards from either the Sun OS manual or various books, just picking off system calls one by one and trying to make something that worked. It was really frustrating for him. The reason? Because nothing is happening, you can't really see any progress. You can make small test programs that test whatever it is you just added, but that doesn't really accomplish anything. After a while, he got to the point where, instead of just reading through a list of system calls, he gave up on that approach. It was getting complete enough that he wanted to run a real program. The first program you have to run is a shell, because without a shell, it's pretty hard to run anything else. And besides, the shell itself contains many of the system calls you will need. Get it running, and you will be able to print out a running list of the system calls you haven't implemented. In Unix, the shell is kind of the mother of all programs. It's there to start up other binaries. A binary is a program in the ones and zeros that a machine reads. Whenever you write a program in a computer language, you then compile the source code and it becomes a binary. The shell allows you to log on in the first place. The first thing Linus's kernel did was to start the shell. He had implemented about 25 system calls. This was the first real program he was trying to run. The shell wasn't something he had written himself. He had downloaded onto a disk a clone of the Bourne shell, which was one of the original Unix shells. It was available over the internet as free software. It was late August or early September when he finally got the shell working. From that point, things got a lot easier. This was a big deal. When he got the shell working, he was pretty much immediately able to compile a few other programs. At some point, there was enough in place that he experienced a "let there be light" moment, because until then, nothing had really worked. Yes, Linus felt a great sense of satisfaction. That was particularly important because he hadn't been doing anything that summer except working on the computer. The shell was operational, which meant that Linus had actually built the foundation of a working operating system. And he was having fun. With the shell working, he started testing its built-in programs. Then he compiled enough new programs to actually do something. He was compiling everything in Minix, but he moved the shell over to a special partition that he had created for the new operating system. Privately, he called it Linux. He didn't want to ever release it under the name Linux because it was too egotistical. What was the name Linus reserved for any eventual release? Freaks, F-R-E-A-X. Get it? Freaks, with a requisite X. In fact, some of the early make files, the files that describe how to compile the sources, included the word freaks for about half a year. But it really didn't matter. At that point, Linus didn't need a name for it because he wasn't releasing it to anybody. In the end, it wasn't much of a decision for Linus to post it. That was how he was accustomed to exchanging programs, so the only real question was, at what point would he be comfortable to dare show this off to people? Or, phrased more accurately, when is it good enough that he won't have to be ashamed of it? By the time the shell worked, Linus had a few rudimentary binaries he'd compiled for the operating system. You really couldn't do anything, but you could see that it was something resembling Unix. In fact, it worked like a very crippled Unix. So he just decided he would make it available. He wouldn't tell anybody publicly. Instead, he just informed a handful of people by private email, probably between 5 and 10 people in all, that he had uploaded it to the FTP site. Among them were Bruce Evans of Minix fame and Ari Lemke. Linus uploaded the sources to Linux itself and a few binaries so that you could start something. He told people what they needed to do in order to try and run this thing. They still had to have Minix installed, the 386 version, and they still had to have the GCC compiler. In fact, they had to have his version of GCC, so he made that available too. There's a protocol for numbering releases. It's psychological. When you think a version is truly ready to be released, you number it version 1.0. But before that, you number the earlier versions to indicate how much work you need to accomplish before getting to 1.0. With that in mind, the operating system Linus posted to the FTP site was numbered version 0.01. That tells everybody it's not ready for much. The date, September 17th, 1991. Linus thinks that not more than one or two people ever checked it out. They had to go to the trouble of installing the special compiler, getting a clean partition so they could use that to boot, compiling his kernel, and then running just the shell. Running the shell was basically all you could do. You could print out the sources, which amounted to just 10,000 lines. That's less than 100 pages of paper, if you printed with small font. Now it's something on the order of 10 million lines. One of the main reasons Linus distributed the operating system was to prove that it wasn't all just hot air, that he had actually done something. On the internet, talk is cheap. Regardless of what you do, whether it's operating systems or sex, too many people are just faking it in cyberspace. And Ari Lemke, who ensured that it made its way to the FTP site, hated the name Freaks. He preferred the other working name Linus was using, Linux, and named the posting pub/os/linux. Linus didn't put up much of a fight, but it was Ari's doing. Linus thought, okay, that's a good name, and I can always blame somebody else for it. Linus's operating system really wasn't very useful. For one thing, it would crash very easily if you filled up memory or if you did anything nasty. Even if you weren't doing anything nasty, the operating system would crash if you kept it running for any length of time. But it wasn't meant to be run at that stage. It was meant to be looked at. Yes, and admired. Reaction was invariably positive, but positive in a kind of, it would be nice if it could also do this kind of sense, or, it looks cool, but it really doesn't work on my computer at all. Linus remembers one email whose writer said he really liked the operating system, and he went on for at least one paragraph to tell Linus how nice it was. Then he explained that it had just eaten his hard disk, and that the disk driver was flaky or something. He had lost all the work he had done, but he was still very positive. It was fun for Linus to read that kind of email. It was a bug report about something that screwed him up. That was the sort of feedback Linus was looking for. He fixed some bugs, like the one that caused it to lock up when it ran out of memory, and he made the big step of porting the GCC compiler to the operating system so he could compile small programs. Early October saw the release of version 0.02, which included some fixed bugs and a few additional programs. The following month, Linus released version 0.03. He probably would have stopped by the end of 1991 He had done a lot of things he thought were interesting. Everything didn't really work perfectly, but in a software kind of world, Linus found that once you solve the fundamental problems of a project, it's easy to lose interest. And that's what was happening to him. Trying to debug software is not very engaging. Then two things happened to keep him going. First, he destroyed his Minix partition by mistake. Second, people kept sending him feedback. Back then, he was booting into Linux, but used Minix as the main development environment. Most of what he was doing under Linux was reading email and news from the university's computer via the terminal emulator he had written. The university computer was constantly busy, so he had written a program that auto-dialed into it. But in December, he mistakenly auto-dialed his hard disk instead of his modem. He was trying to auto-dial the serial line, but by mistake, he auto-dialed the hard disk device. The end result was that he inadvertently overwrote some of the most critical parts of the partition where he had Minix. That meant he couldn't boot Minix anymore. That was the point where Linus had a decision to make. He could reinstall Minix, or he could bite the bullet and acknowledge that Linux was good enough that he didn't need Minix. He would write the programs to compile Linux under itself, and whenever he felt he needed Minix, he would just add the desired feature to Linux. It's a big conceptual step when you drop the original hosting environment and truly make a program self-hosting. So big that Linus released the new version as 0.10 in late November. A few weeks later came version 0.11. In December, there was this guy in Germany who only had 2 megabytes of RAM, and he was trying to compile the kernel, and he couldn't run GCC because GCC at the time needed more than a megabyte. He asked Linus if Linux could be compiled with a smaller compiler that wouldn't need as much memory. So Linus decided that even though he didn't need the particular feature, he would make it happen for the guy. It's called page to disk, and it means that even though someone has only 2 megabytes of RAM, he can make it appear to be more by using the disk for memory. This was around Christmas, 1991. Linus remembers trying to make the page to disk work on December 23rd. By December 24th, it kind of worked, but crashed every once in a while. Then on December 25th, it was done. It was basically the first feature he added to serve somebody else's need. And he was proud of it. Page to disk was a fairly big thing because it was something Minix had never done. It was included in version 0.12, which was released in the first week of January, 1992. Immediately, people started to compare Linux not only to Minix, but to Coherent, which was a small Unix clone developed by Mark Williams' company. From the beginning, the act of adding page to disk caused Linux to rise above the competition. That's when Linux took off. Suddenly, there were people switching over from Minix to Linux. At the time, Linux didn't do everything Minix did, but it did most of the things people really cared about, and it had this one capability that people really, really cared about. With page to disk, you could run bigger programs than you had memory for. It meant that when you ran out of memory, you could take an old piece of memory, save it off to disk, remember where you saved it, and reuse that memory for the problem you had to solve. This was a big deal in the opening weeks of 1992. It was in January that Linux users grew from 5, 10, 20 people, folks who Linus could email and whose names he knew, to hundreds of unidentifiable people. Linus didn't know everybody using Linux, and that was fun. About this time, there was a hoax speeding its way on the internet. Some poor boy named Craig was dying of cancer, and a popular chain letter urged you to show your support by sending him a postcard. It turned out to be somebody's idea of a sick joke. Craig probably never really existed, much less suffered from cancer, but the appeal generated millions of postcards. So Linus was only half serious when he asked for postcards instead of money from people who used Linux. It was like an, oh God, not another email that asks for postcards joke. In the PC world at the time, there had been a strong tradition of shareware. You downloaded a program and you were supposed to send in something on the order of $10 to the writer. Linus was getting emails from people asking him if he would like them to send him $30 or so. He had to say something. The money would have been useful. Linus had amassed something like $5,000 in student loans and had to shell out about $50 a month to pay off his computer. His other major expenditures were pizza and beer. But Linux was keeping him so preoccupied that he wasn't going out much at the time, maybe once a week at most. He didn't need money for dates, although he could have used it for hardware add-ons, but that wasn't necessary. Probably a different son would have asked for money for his program, if only to fork over some rent to his working single mom. It never occurred to Linus at the time. He was more interested in seeing where people were using Linux. Instead of cash, he preferred postcards, and they poured in, from New Zealand, from Japan, from the Netherlands, from the United States. The postcards totaled in the hundreds, and Linus has no idea what happened to them. There were a variety of reasons why Linus didn't want the money. When he originally posted Linux, he felt he was following in the footsteps of centuries of scientists and other academics who built their work on the foundations of others, on the shoulders of giants, in the words of Sir Isaac Newton. Not only was Linus sharing his work so that others could find it useful, he also wanted feedback. It didn't make sense for him to charge people who could potentially help him improve his work. Linus says he would have approached it all differently if he hadn't been raised in Finland, where anyone exhibiting the slightest sign of greediness is viewed with suspicion, if not envy. He undoubtedly would have approached the whole no money thing a lot differently if he had not been brought up under the influence of a die-hard academic grandfather and a die-hard communist father. Regardless, Linus didn't want to sell Linux, and he didn't want to lose control, which meant he didn't want anybody else to sell it either. He made that clear in the copyright policy he included in the copying file of the first version he had uploaded back in September. Thanks to the Berne Convention in Europe in the 1800s, you own the copyright to anything you create, unless you sell the copyright. As the copyright owner, Linus got to make up the rules. You can use the operating system for free, as long as you don't sell it, and if you make any changes or improvements, you must make them available to everybody in source code, as opposed to binaries, which are inaccessible. If you didn't agree with these rules, you didn't have the right to copy the code or do anything with it. While Linus wasn't interested in asking for money for Linux, other people were not shy about requesting donations whenever they gave someone a copy of the operating system they had loaded onto a floppy disk. The trouble was, that was a violation of his copyright. It was time to rethink his Linux is not for sale stance. By that point, Linux was getting so much online discussion that he felt fairly confident that nobody was going to be in a position to just take it and run with it, which had been his big fear. The momentum had been established. On a daily basis, hackers from around the world were sharing their suggested changes. They were collectively creating the best operating system around and couldn't possibly veer away from their trajectory. Because of this, and because Linux had become so recognizable, Linus felt comfortable allowing people to sell it. But there was another critical element of Linus's decision. The fact is, to make Linux usable, he had relied on a lot of tools that had been distributed freely over the internet. He had hoisted himself up on the shoulders of giants. The most important of these free software programs was the GCC compiler. It had been copyrighted under the General Public License, universally known as a GPL, or the Copyleft, which was the brainchild of Richard Stallman. Under terms of the GPL, money is not the issue. You can charge $1 million if somebody's willing to pay it, but you have to make sources available. And the person you give or sell the source code to has to have all the rights you have. It's a brilliant device, but unlike many hardcore GPL freaks who argue that every new software innovation should be opened up to the universe under the general public license, Linus believes it should be the right of the individual inventor to decide what to do with his or her invention. So he dumped his old copyright and adopted the GPL, a document that Stallman had written with lawyers looking it over. Because lawyers were involved, it runs on for pages. The new copyright was included in version 0.12, but Linus remembers lying awake at night after releasing it, nervous about what commercial interests would do to the system. The commercial interest was relatively small, but something made Linus think that he had to be careful. One of his worries was, and still is, that somebody would just take Linux and not honor the copyright. Back then, he worried that it would be practically impossible to sue anyone in the United States who broke the copyright. It's still a concern. It's easy to prosecute someone for such violations, but he worries about somebody doing it until they're forced to stop. His fears are mitigated by reality. Somebody might do it for a while, but it is the people who actually honor the copyright, who feed back their changes to the kernel and have it improved, who are going to have a leg up. They'll be part of the process of upgrading the kernel. By contrast, people who don't honor the GPL will not be able to take advantage of the upgrades, and their customers, hopefully, will leave them. When it comes to Linux, who cares if an individual doesn't really follow the GPL if they're using the program for their own purposes? It's when somebody goes in for the quick money. That's what Linus finds immoral, whether it happens in the United States or Africa. And even then, it's a matter of degree. Greed is never good. The attention wasn't all positive. Although confrontation has never been Linus's best sport, he was bullied into defending Linux and his manhood when Andrew Tannenbaum kept making attacks on the operating system that was supplanting his own. They're both nerds, so it was all done via email. For starters, Tannenbaum was unhappy about Linus infringing on his newsgroup, and he wasn't too pleased that his operating system was becoming eclipsed by this new creation from the snowy wilds of Finland, and that so many developers were joining the project. He also had opposing ideas for how operating systems should be built. At the time, Andrew was part of a camp of computer scientists who favored the microkernel approach to operating systems. He had done Minix as a microkernel, and Amoeba, the system he was working on at the time, also involved one. This was a flourishing movement in the late 1980s and early 1990s, and Linux's success was threatening it. So he kept posting unpleasant little jabs. The theory behind the microkernel is that operating systems are complicated. So you try to get some of the complexity out by modularizing it a lot. The tenet of the microkernel approach is that the kernel, which is the core of the core of the core, should do as little as possible. Its main function is to communicate. All the different things that the computer offers are services that are available through the microkernel communications channels. In the microkernel approach, you're supposed to split up the problem space so much that none of it is complex. Linus thought this was stupid. Yes, it makes every single piece simple, but the interactions make it far more complex than it would be if many of the services were included in the kernel itself, as they are in Linux. Think of your brain. Every single piece is simple, but the interactions between the pieces make for a highly complex system. It's the whole is bigger than the parts problem. If you take a problem and split it in half, and say that the halves are half as complicated, you're ignoring the fact that you have to add in the complication of communication between the two halves. The theory behind the microkernel was that you split the kernel into 50 independent parts, and each of the parts is a 50th of the complexity. But then everybody ignores the fact that the communication among the parts is actually more complicated than the original system was, never mind the fact that the parts are still not trivial. That's the biggest argument against microkernels. The simplicity you try to reach is a false simplicity. Linux started out much smaller and much, much simpler. It didn't enforce modularity, so you could do a lot of things more straightforwardly than you ever could with Minix. One of the original problems Linus had with Minix was that if you had 5 different programs running at the same time, and they all want to read 5 different files, the tasks would be serialized. In other words, you would have 5 different processes sending requests to the file system. Can I please read from file X? The file system daemon that handles reading takes one of them and sends it back, then takes the next one and sends it back, and so on. Under Linux, which is a monolithic kernel, you have five different processes that each do a system call to the kernel. The kernel has to be very careful that they don't get confused with each other, but it very naturally scales up to any number of processes doing whatever they want. It makes Linux much faster and much more efficient. Linus and I leave our families and friends back at the campsite and take an afternoon hike along a clear stream. We're camping at Grover Hot Springs, way up in the Eastern Sierra, over the July 4th weekend, at a site that seems to have been lifted from the pages of National Geographic. "This is a Kodak moment," Linus proclaims, pausing to look out over a wildflower-dusted meadow and the dramatic cliffs that provide the backdrop. We settle at a site along the stream, and I ask him to describe his life during those days when Linux's appeal was spreading far beyond its original family of newsgroup enthusiasts, few of whom Linus had even personally met. "It must have felt great," I say. "For years you were toiling away on your own in your bedroom, with little contact with the world outside your CPU. Suddenly, you have people from every corner of the planet acknowledging what great work you're doing. You're the center of this growing community that is looking to you to..." "I don't have a memory of it being a big deal for me," he replies. "I really don't think it was. It was kind of the thing I was thinking about all the time, but mainly because there was always a problem to be solved. In that sense, I was thinking about it a lot. But it was not, emotionally, a big thing. Intellectually, it was something big. I liked the fact that there were a lot of people giving me motivation to do this project. I thought I had seen the end of it, a point where it was almost done, but that point never came because people kept giving me more reasons to continue and more brain teasers to worry about, and that kept it interesting. Otherwise, I probably would have just moved on to another project, because that's how I worked, and that was fun." "What was your family's reaction to everything that was happening to Linux?" I ask. "They must have been pretty excited about it." "I don't think anybody really noticed," he replies. "I won't say that nobody really cared, but I had been doing programming most of my life, and this was not anything different as far as they were concerned." "Well, you must have said something to your folks. Like if your dad was driving you someplace, didn't you say, 'Hey, you're not going to believe this, but do you know this stuff I've been doing with my computer? Well, I've got hundreds of people who are using it.'" "No," he answers. "I just didn't feel the need to share this with my family and friends. I never had the feeling that I wanted to push it on people. To me, the fact that people used it was nice, and it was wonderful that I got comments back, but at the same time, it was not that important. I didn't want to spread the gospel. I was proud of having people use my code, but I don't remember ever having the feeling that I wanted to share that with anybody, and I didn't think it was the most important thing on earth. I didn't think that I was doing something really important because 100 people were using my software. It was more like it was fun. And that's how I feel about it today." Linus buys a new car, a 2-seater convertible that he says defines the word fun. It is metallic blue, the perfect boy's model car color. He chose that shade because the vehicle doesn't come in bright yellow, his color of choice. A little more than a year earlier, we had taken our first trip over the mountain to Santa Cruz in a convertible I had rented for the occasion. And during that excursion, Linus had made a point of stopping to check out the sports cars parked outside the sauna place and brewery we visited. Now we are headed over the mountain in his own sports car. He smiles as he takes the curves on Route 17. "You deserve this," I say. I pull a handful of CDs from the glove compartment. "Pink Floyd?" I ask. "The Who? Janis Joplin?" He says, "It's the music I grew up listening to. I never bought music when I was a kid, but we had this around the apartment. I guess my mother was playing it, although I remember she was big on Elvis Costello." We park among shoddier vehicles along the side of Highway 1, a bit north of Santa Cruz, and make our way down to a mostly empty beach. We spread out on towels in the warm sun and wait a few minutes before I pull my tape recorder from my backpack. Again, I ask him to describe himself in those early days. He draws a box in the sand to represent his bedroom, then indicates the location of his bed and computer. I would roll out of bed and immediately check my email, he says, moving his finger accordingly. Some days, I don't think I ever left the apartment. I wasn't checking my email just to see who was sending me email. It was more a matter of seeing if a particular problem had been fixed. It was more like, what new exciting issue do we have today? Or, if we had a problem, who had a solution? Linus tells me that his social life at the time was pathetic. Then he figures that sounds too pathetic, so he amends it. Let's say it was one notch above pathetic. I didn't become a total, complete recluse, he says. But even though Linux was happening, I was still as antisocial as I had ever been. You notice that I never contact people by phone? It's always been true. I never call. Most people who are my friends are the kind of people who contact people, and I'm not. You can imagine what that's like for dating, if you never call the woman. So during that time, I had a few friends who just came knocking on my window, wanting to come in for a cup of tea. I don't think anybody could really tell the difference at that time. Oh, he's doing something really big and important, and someday he'll change the world. I don't think anybody really thought anything of the sort. Linus's single regular social event in those days was the weekly Spectrum meeting, where he mingled with other science majors. He adds, one of the reasons I liked Spectrum so much was that it was a framework for being social without having to be social. That was the evening I was social, and every other evening I sat in front of the computer. It was much more of an emotional thing than Linux ever was. Linux was never something I got really upset about. I never lost any sleep over Linux. One of the things that made Linux good and motivational was the feedback I was getting, he says. It meant that Linux mattered and was a sign of my being in a social group, and I was the leader of the social group. There's no question that was important. More important than even telling my mom and dad what I was doing. I was more concerned about the people who were using Linux. I had created a social circle and had the respect of those people. That's not how I thought of it at the time, and it's still not how I think of it, but it must be the most important thing. The sun begins its descent into the Pacific, and it's time to leave the beach. Linus insists that I drive his car home to see how well it responds, and that we take the long and winding way, Route 9, back to Silicon Valley. The hotel room was only slightly above freezing as Linus lay in bed, shivering, the night before his first speech. In the Netherlands, they don't heat places like they do in Finland, and this drafty room even had huge, single-pane windows, as if it were meant to be occupied only in the summer. But the coldness wasn't the only thing keeping him awake on the night of November 4th, 1993. He was nervous beyond belief. Public speaking had always been a rough spot for Linus. In school, they made students give presentations about something they had heavily researched, rats or whatever, and Linus always found it impossible to do. He would stand up there, unable to talk, and just start giggling. And trust me, Linus is not a giggler. He was even uncomfortable when he had to go up to the blackboard to show the class how he figured out a problem. But there he was in Ede, the Netherlands, an hour's train ride from Amsterdam, because he had been invited to speak at the 10th anniversary of the Netherlands Unix Users Group. He wanted to prove to himself that he could do this. A year earlier, he had been asked to speak before a similar organization in Spain, but declined because his fear of public speaking was greater than his desire to travel. And back then, he really loved to travel. He still likes traveling, but it's not nearly the novelty it was for a kid who had barely been out of Finland. The only places he had ever been were Sweden, where the family took a few camping vacations, and Moscow, where they visited his dad when he was about 6 years old.